time to talk about the post office, you might have heard about the scandal which engulfed it over in Britain, where hundreds of sub-postmasters had their lives ruined by a faulty accounting system called Horizon. Many were falsely accused of stealing thousands of pounds. Some were even convicted and jailed. And more lost marriages, families and their mental health, when in fact the shortfalls they were finding weren't isolated cases of fraud, but glitches in the accounting software. It's been described as one of the most widespread miscarriages of justice in British history. And even this morning, there are calls for the Post Office to face a police investigation after the BBC has revealed the company knew of flaws in that Horizon IT system. A document shows bosses and lawyers knew as far back as 2017, but kept arguing that sub-postmasters were to blame. Now, a faulty accounting system doesn't perhaps sound like the makings of a gripping drama, but it has been made into a series called Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Here is a taster of what the postmasters were up against.
The computer system Post Office spent an arm and a leg on is faulty.
No one else has ever reported any problems with Horizon. No one.
You're responsible for the loss.
I haven't got that money, and I don't know where it's gone.
All our hopes, all our savings down the pan.
That was a lie, actually. We are fighting a war against an enemy owned by the British government, while we're just skint little people.
Well, the series was written by Gwyneth Hughes, a journalist turned screenwriter. I asked her how she became interested in this, not just as a story, but as a TV adaptation.
This has always been knocking around, you know, for more than 20 years. It all began over 20 years ago. But it's a kind of complex, difficult, weird subject, lots of difficult computer stuff, lots of hard to understand stuff in throughout it. And also the people involved, you know, they're not a fashionable group. They're small shopkeepers. They're mostly elderly. They're not cool. And I really like that about them. Obviously, I think that's really interesting. And it's not a kind of person that you mainly see on the telly. And so I had been aware of the story and of this terrible scandal brewing, but I'd read bits and bobs in the papers and heard stuff on the radio, but I'd never really understood it. And in fact, not only had I not understood it, but I thought that just sounds mad. Surely that kind of thing can't happen in England, you know, rules of cricket, decency, law and order, you know, we're all kind, aren't we? And I think you'd probably feel the same way if something like this happened in New Zealand. I mean, it probably has happened in New Zealand. I just don't know about it. So, yeah, when the opportunity came to look into it more deeply, I quickly found that it was just the most extraordinary story and really worthy of my time and of the time and attention of millions of the viewing public. And that's how it turned out because, you know, I have to tell you, we were all completely astonished by how well this quite small show did and how well it's doing all over the world. Because, I don't know, this subject, this theme of the little guy, the little girl, the small people at the mercy of government departments who don't care and corporations who don't listen, you know, you think it won't happen to nice, respectable people like this, but it does, and it did in Britain over 20 years. Mm. And so, yeah, this story, you know, just grabbed my imagination. As soon as I met the people involved, as soon as I met the human beings involved in it, I knew I wanted to tell it.
How did you get to that point where you were meeting some of the people who are now characters in the series?
Well, I mean, it was quite difficult. Apart from anything else, we were rampaging COVID at the time. You know, you remember that well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
COVID lockdowns, you know about them better than anybody. And my first conversations with these people were over the phone, over Zoom. I mean, I don't know about you, Susie, but I'm so over Zoom.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being on Zoom with us today. But yes, we are all a bit over Zoom.
Yeah, this is all audio. This is fine. This isn't like hideous video calls and, you know, peering each other down horrible, kind of badly lit rooms and people asking people to share with you, you know, over this horrible system, the worst thing that had ever happened to them, their memories of the worst thing that's ever happened to them. So I was very glad when the lockdown began to ease and I got straight in the car and off we went to meet them for real and do the whole, you know, many cups of tea and many packets of Kleenex routine, while they told me stories which were unbelievable, very upsetting, and sometimes very difficult to grasp, because it is a complicated story. Mm. It is a story about computers. And, you know, I'm the last person, actually, who should ever have been hired to write a story about complicated computer business, because I'm just like, you know, rubbish. Oh, you know that woman in episode one, Joe? Yeah. You know, when she blames herself, she thinks it's her, she doesn't understand what's going on. That's me. That's like 100% me. So I really over-identified with her when I met her and she told me these stories. I'm like, that would have been me. Whereas Alan Bates, the hero of our show, the hero of the whole saga, he wasn't like that at all. He knew from the beginning that it wasn't his fault. He knew it was their fault. He just had to prove it, which took him 20 years. But he never had that self-doubt that Joe had, and I would have had if I'd have been in that position. Mm. You know, I felt a great deal of personal identification with them.
For those who don't know the story, give us a sense of what this is about. As you say, it is about computers, but this ruined people's lives and livelihoods, and it really erupted into being a national scandal in the UK.
Yes, it's a huge national scandal. It's really hit a nerve. It's hit everybody, you know, in the guts to hear about these respectable, kindly people being disbelieved in favour of a computer system that was faulty. So what happened briefly is that this network of small post offices, the kind I'm sure you have similar things in New Zealand, where you've got villages and towns and streets where the focus is a small grocery or a small shop where the post office is also resident. And out of that shop, people might sell groceries, they might sell greetings cards, but they also sell stamps and they take parcels and they dole out benefits and they do all these different tasks that are really central to the life of the community. And people go into this trade because they want to help and they want to be they want to give back and they want to be community minded. Some years ago, the post office nationally introduced a new computer system to help them with the accountancy, basically, because as you can imagine, the accountancy issues are huge. So they put in this new computer system. It, like all new computer systems, hadn't been properly tested, nobody really knew how it worked. In it went, and it immediately began to throw up what looked like evidence of thieving. It looked, if you just looked at what the computer said, it looked like some of these sub-postmasters had been stealing from their own tills. This was not the case. This was not true. Many years later, it's been proven that the problems were caused by artifacts and mistakes in the programming of the computer. But at the time, people said, sub-postmasters said, I'm not a villain, I'm not a thief. You know, come and turn me over, do what you like. But I'm not a villain. And they were not believed. Not only were they not believed, but they were each told, you are the only one suffering these problems. So not only were their lives in ruins and their livelihood in ruins and their life savings down the drain, but they are all being told, you're the only one. And you know what? That's part of it that upsets me the most. To think of yourself or them in a situation where everything is collapsing around you, nobody believes you, everybody thinks you're a thief and a villain, and they're all telling you you're the only one this is happening to. And they knew, post office knew that wasn't true. And it has ruined and ended lives and ruined many others. There are thousands of people affected. They're all now due for, they're all now claiming, it's not compensation they're claiming because it's not for their hurt feelings. You know, what they want is the money that the post office stole off them. They want that money back so they can start their lives again. People have lost their houses. People have lost their marriages, their health, and in some cases, their lives. You know, it's appalling. It's appalling, but it's also a bunch of not very fashionable people all over the country. It's all rather confusing. We make a show about it, and on the day that we broadcast it, our boss sent us all around a kind of comforting email, and he said, now let's just take a breath and the show isn't going to do that well in the ratings, and you know we're going to get defeated. And never mind, he said, the show will find an audience, and that's what television people say when they mean nobody's going to watch it. We got up the next day, and the ratings were through the roof, and they continued to go through the roof, and it built and built, and it turned into this extraordinary phenomenon. And you know, we don't take, as the TV drama team, we do not take credit for that. The credit for that is that the story, the people's stories, the way they told them, the terrible things that happened to innocent people, were just so resonant. And British public were ready to hear this, and ready to get very angry about it.
I'm intrigued that when it's such a compelling story, that the TV bosses didn't think it would do well.
Well, it was New Year's Day. We were up against, you know, the show The Tourist, the first season of which was set in Australia. It was a big hit. I loved it. And the BBC ran the second season of The Tourist against us. It was New Year's Day. We thought, people will want something a bit more entertaining. They probably want comedy. Everybody's broke. Everybody's hungover. They're not going to sit and watch this quite serious show. And we underestimated them. We underestimated the audience. They were really ready for it. I mean, when I first came into this story, I knew a little bit about it and was a bit ashamed that I didn't know more. And I think in general, that's how the audience felt. They'd heard about it, but it felt a bit, maybe if we watch this show, then we'll have a bit more idea whatever it is that's been going on. Mm. And then you start to watch it and you realise that what was going on was unbelievable. You know, like all the best true stories is actually unbelievable. Mm. What you see unfold, I watch it unfold and I go, I just don't believe this. But I tell you every word of it is true. Yeah. She really did sit there and watch the amount of her so-called deficit double in front of her eyes when she was only doing what the call centre told her to do. And we've all done that. We've all been there. Yeah, we've all been on the end of a line to a call centre who is supposed to be helping us and isn't. And I think on that very basic level, people really, really identified with it and responded to it. You know, we've all been there,
but there
in
were,
our little way.
Indeed, there were also points where I read that it had made no financial sense to make the show, that there were some real bottlenecks on funding even as the show was getting made.
Oh, yeah, we had terrible problems financially. I mean, the way the whole global television industry now works is that you have to get money from overseas to make your show. You have to have American money. You have to have sales to overseas. You can't actually just find the money in the UK or indeed, I'm sure, in New Zealand to make your own programmes. Well, it's a bit of a big ask to go to American broadcasters and say, hey, we've got this great story. It's about this bunch of little guys in, you know, I don't know, Northampton, in daft places, and it's all, you know, small. Will you give us some money, please? And they were saying, well, why would our audience want to watch this? And actually, it starts transmission in the US next week, because in the US too, they have it. Everybody realised that there are communities and individuals under this pressure everywhere in the world. Everyone's got stories like this. And so something about it just grabs people's attention. And as it happens, as it's turned out, I think ITV is going to make up the loss that it incurred in making this programme. But they went into it knowing that they were going to make a loss because we couldn't make it. We were cutting filming days, we were cutting actors. So we did struggle. But everybody was so committed, you know, a lot of the crew and actors, lots of them took lower rates of pay than they would normally expect because the commitment was so great to make this show and to get this story out there. So, you know, for them as well, it's just fantastic that little sacrifice that they made financially has paid off because it really worked. It was worth doing. It was worth everybody's time. It's funny because everybody, all the actors, you know, we got all our first choice actors. This never happened. You've always got several lists, first choice, second choice. And on this show, everybody we asked wanted to be in it because they could see that it was really important. And everybody felt, I think, that they were, you know, it's really rare. We're just entertainers. I'm just an entertainer. And to find ourselves Actually doing good, you know, helping people through our work has been very unusual and very refreshing. You know, it's been great. Won't happen again.
You're listening to Saturday Morning with Susie Ferguson. My guest is Gwyneth Hughes, writer of Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, which you'll be able to see on TVNZ and, of course, on TVNZ Plus. Interested that you say you're just an entertainer, because you are, but also you were a journalist and a documentary maker. How did you end up making the move into drama?
How did I do that? Well, I think, you know, funnily enough, it's all the same thing. I mean, we're all just telling stories, aren't we? We gather the material, whether it's from real life or from stuff we just made up out of our heads, and then we organize that into a story and tell it. And I think I just wanted the there came a point when I wanted the freedom to make stuff up. And some cynics might say that journalists do that all the time. But I must say, I didn't do that. I was very good. So I wanted to just to try fiction, to try making stuff up, to try telling stories that way. And I have made completely fictional pieces. But some years ago, I got tempted into making dramas based on true stories, which is a very odd discipline. It's a very peculiar thing. And I've done several of these now. This is the biggest one. But they're very odd in all sorts of ways. And one of them is, you know, when you're writing something for the telly, there's various people you have to please. You have to please the people who pay for the scripts. You have to please the audience. You have to please yourself, you know, to make yourself think that you've done decent work. But when you're doing this kind of project, more importantly than any of that, you have to please the people who've trusted you with their stories. And so there was a night when we had a screening of this show for the sub-postmasters who took part in it. And honestly, I was so nervous. I was just, oh, what if they didn't like it? What if they didn't think that we'd done a good job? And oh God, the relief. They all loved it. They were, you know, all these happy faces, all these smiling faces. They really felt that we told their story and put their story and their point out there. So that was a huge relief. But I mean, the thing is about telling, you know, you can do as much journalism as you like, and I've done loads. When you make a drama arising from a story like this, you know, so the best journalism, the best documentary, you're always remembering, aren't you? You're always saying, yeah, I remember that night this happened. It's reporting. I remember the night that they came and told me that I'd lost my post office. When you make a drama, you right there in the moment, you go back to that moment and you sit an actor in that moment, and you see it happen, you see it unfold in real time. And that's very powerful. And I think that's one of the reasons why a drama has so much impact, you know, compared even to the best documentary. You're actually there. And bearing in mind that drama was actually invented for this purpose, you know, thousands of years ago, ancient Greeks, whatever. Drama was invented to appeal to an audience, to grab an audience from off the stage and say, care about this, laugh at this, be scared of this, cry, you know, care. And that's what drama does, and you know what it was invented to do. And I think that's another reason why our show has been such a success. I mean, God, I'm talking like this. Hope it's a success in New Zealand. You might make.
Oh no, I'm sure it will be a success over here. It's, you know, it's a real it's kind of a classic of the genre in some way. And to know that those people that you're seeing on the screen, the actors are portraying real people who, you know, whose real lives were impacted largely in the way that you see. It kind of adds an extra level, doesn't it? And there's a complexity, I guess, that comes from telling a real story that has those ongoing effects, keeping close to the truth, but then also the need to dramatize that situation. It's a difficult balance.
Well, I mean, there are writers and production teams out there who will take a much looser view of this than we did. I mean, I was a journalist, and I am a historian, and I want to tell the truth. I mean, if I say to the audience, this is a true story, it better had be a true story. You know, I don't I try my absolute hardest to keep it as true as is physically possible. given that there were four episodes, each of them 45 minutes long. So most of what you'll find that you have to do writing this kind of thing is you have to simplify and take stuff out. For instance, you might see someone with one child in real life. They have three children, haven't got the room for three children, and they haven't got the money to pay three teachers for those individual child actors on the day. It's simplifications like that that I go in for, but I do try my absolute hardest to produce a result that is true, that feels true to the people who told me their story. You know, they're the first people going to take me down if I tell untruths about their lives. Others are postmasters, and they all loved it. So it is a difficult balance. I mean, because, you know, real life is inherently not very dramatic. I mean, in the sense that, I don't know what your life is like, Susie, but mine, it goes round and round in circles, make the same mistakes over and over again, you know. So, whereas in a drama has to go from A to B to Z. You know, it has to go in a straight line. And we all know that life isn't like that. So you're trying to, that the really big thing is to try to find the drama that's inherent in these situations, not to dramatize it, but to find it and make it fly, allow it to fly, and not make stuff up. Mm. Just don't make stuff up. It's a true story. Go away and, you know, go and do another drama that's made up. This one, keep it as true as you possibly can, you know, and then make that claim you're watching a true story.
Yeah. I guess I'm interested too in your commitment and your interest to this story. You know, we've talked about the funding challenges, we've talked about how the TV bosses didn't think it would do that well. Did you always think it would be popular? Did you think it was going to resonate?
I thought people would like it. I thought people would come to it. I mean, it's got a great cast and I thought it was a great story, but I didn't think that it was going to change the law or change the world or just become part of our history in the way it has. Mm. It's been extraordinary. It's been really, really extraordinary. And I don't expect it ever to happen again to me. And I just hope that after all the sort of fuss and bother has died down, that it does ultimately help the postmasters to get their, to get their money back, to get their lives back, to get vindicated.
Mm. It has, as you say, revived interest, not just in the story, but also, of course, in the kind of the political realm of things. It has had real world consequences for the bosses at the post office. The Prime Minister has been commenting on it. It those ripples go far and wide.
Yes, and that's all still going on. And we have a public inquiry going on right now. And over the next couple of months, that's just going to be spectacular, because all the bosses at the post office are going to trail past the public inquiry and they're going to have to give their version. I mean, assuming they do. It's been huge. And, you know, since the 1st of January when we transmitted this show, every day there's been something in the newspaper, something on the television news. It continues to lead the news. It continues to ripple onwards. And it's going to do that, I think, for the rest of this year. It's huge. Yeah.